Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org, or the number for more information is 1-800-888-8823. Open Society Institute has a Talking by Race series they've been doing now for a couple of years, an incredible series that brings people together to wrestle with different issues around race in America. And we've been covering that series ever since they've been doing it and doing conversations leading up to it for every one of those. And today is no different. The one coming up tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Enoch Pratt Library on Cathedral Street, the Central Branch, at 7 p.m. is a conversation that is entitled "Why Are African American Males Struggling in School?" And two incredibly interesting speakers. One right here from Morgan State University, Dr. Raymond Winbush, who is director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University. Dr. Ivory Tolson, associate professor at Howard University, editor in chief of the Journal of Negro Education, and senior research analyst at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. And Raymond, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Mark. Good to see you, man.
And Ivory will be with us in about 10 or 15 minutes. He had to finish another session he was working on, and then we'll call right in and be part of the show. So,
sure.
Good to have you here. Thank
good
you.
To be here again.
This is a subject that is, you know, one of those subjects that everybody likes, that not likes to, but has been bemoaning for years about the gap and why it exists, and people trying to wrestle and put their hands around it forever and ever. And in some ways, it's gotten worse rather than better.
Well, it's gotten worse in some areas and better in others. I mean, I can't remember when I was driving over here a time when someone wasn't talking about the problem of black boys in public schools. And I'm going back to when I started my education back in the 60s and the 70s. So it clearly predates that. And so I think what has happened is that we want to fix black boys. We want to do something to them. I'm called a lot of times, so is Ivory, to say, tell us how to fix black boys. And I think that we've got to do two things. We got to talk about fixing black boys in quotation marks, but we also have to talk about the system of education in general, and on a broader level, the system of racism that creates this problem in the first place. In the past year, I've been in countries all over the world, England, France, Australia. And every time, if I close my eyes, let's say on the east side of London, it sounds like the east side of Baltimore in terms of parents complaining about what's happening to their black boy. So it's a global problem, but we want to talk about it as if it's a local problem and has nothing to do, of course, with the system of racism that these boys find themselves in.
And so let's talk a bit about the historical aspects of it, also how different it is now. I mean, because we're talking about some really different eras. Yes, it's always been an issue. There was a period of time in the black world because of segregation and fighting to end that everybody was pushing the notion of education, or at least that was an idea.
Sure.
You know, that was popular, seemed to grab the soul of people. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about 60 years or 50 years after the end of segregation, but a huge portion of the African-American world left completely behind, with a different sense.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Mark. See, we always look at, you know, and I always tell people, Little Rock didn't talk about integration, it talked about desegregation,
right.
And there's a
right.
difference.
Big difference.
And we see this increase of the so-called educational deficit after Little Rock and the Supreme Court decision of 54. And so it's clear that
you said an increase in the educational deficit?
Yeah.
Since Little Rock.
And so people say, well, and that's why I said desegregation is a two-edged sword. Sure, it gave us access to better educational facilities. The tax dollar was shared a little bit better. But what it didn't do, it didn't give us the principles and the role models in our schools that we had prior to desegregation. So in the South, for example, in the 14 southern states during desegregation, roughly from 54 to about 63, 1,500 black principals lost their jobs. Hundreds of teachers lost their jobs as a result of desegregation. And we know now from recent studies that black children learn better with black teachers. It doesn't mean that white teachers can't teach black children, but that black children learn more, you know, than white teachers can teach them. And so I think what has happened is that we didn't realize as a result of desegregation how we were going to lose control of our schools. And in losing control of our schools, that we also lost some of the abstract qualities that black teachers brought and the community of educating the child that we haven't gotten as much in our white schools. And then when we see schools like Urban Prep in Chicago, which is all black, and with black teachers, black male teachers, in a graduation class of the last 2 years of every black boy graduating and every black boy receiving scholarships to go to college, we start saying, well, maybe integration, desegregation wasn't so good.
Well, this is a very touchy
It is.
And sensitive subject.
Right. And black folk don't like to deal with it.
Nobody likes to deal with it, right?
Right.
So all right, it's a little anecdotal story. One of the stories you did for On Del Marva was in a small town called Santo Domingo. Mm-hmm. And this small town on the Eastern Shore is a black town, a mm-hmm. historically black town. Mm-hmm. The only free black town in the state
right.
of Maryland.
That's right.
Founded by a Caribbean guy, and so black folks actually own their own land and all the mm-hmm. rest. Okay. And I met them in this building that was one of the spin garden schoolhouses that they built in 1919 mm-hmm. around the country, a big mm-hmm. one. And so everybody in that room was talking about the exact same thing when I interviewed them about the town and the history of it. And they said, we got an incredible education in this little teeny schoolhouse in Santo Domingo. Mm-hmm. And now our children go to schools that are all in these other cities and towns around Santo Domingo on the Eastern Shore. And as he described their middle school, they said, not one of our kids has a black teacher in the entire school.
Exactly.
Which is amazing to even contemplate. This is 21st century on the Eastern Shore that has lots of black folks in it, and there's no black teacher in the school. What is that? I mean, people look at it as mythology that, or hankering back to a better, quote unquote, better time, even despite segregation, when black folks were educating black folks. And that's it. It's
romanticized, but not by that much. I mean, what you've got, see, this is so much to get. I'm going to try
to give your readers' digest
that what's needed in 1954, we started busing people, you know, children back and forth to schools, Boston, all over the place. You know, what we needed was a busing of the dollars. You know, the white schools were, let's say, getting $5 and the black schools were getting 50 cents. If we would have gotten equal amounts of money, this educational deficit, and I'm not the only one saying that. Chuck Willie talks about this extensively at Harvard. That education gap wouldn't have existed. I think what I believe strongly in desegregation, I'm not so sure that I believe in integration. And there's a difference in that I think that a person, regardless of color, should be able to go any place they want to go to school, whatever. Whether or not you should force people to do that, and there was a white reaction to desegregation in this country. Chuck Willie talks about how the interstate system was growing at the same time of Brown versus Board, and that allowed whites to move to the suburbs, take tax dollars out of places like Baltimore. Those schools became less and less prosperous, became more inferior. So all of that stuff happened at the same time. And when you tell black folk, well, would you rather have it like it was in 1954, I give a qualified yes. I think that we're now seeing black schools popping up, independent black schools popping up all over the country. And they're doing very well by the students that attend them. That doesn't mean necessarily. Or we see a little about HBCU. We're sitting at Morgan State University, one of 103, and we know that they do very well in terms of graduating our students, in terms of them becoming leadership in leadership positions throughout the country.
One of the things that we have to, we're wrapping up here for a pitch break here in a minute. So just tell me, okay? Because I want to. When we come back. And I'll ask Ivory Tolson as well when he comes in. I mean, there are studies that I've been sent and I've read that say kids of color who come from poor communities do better in schools if they go to mostly white schools in the suburbs. There's this whole body of literature mm-hmm. that talks about that. and that kids of means who go to mostly poor schools in the cities do worse. So well, let me pick up on that when we come back.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, and wrestle with that one.
Okay.
So, folks, don't go away. We're going to come back to this conversation. 410-319-8888. You can pledge and talk to us at the same time. I mean, you can still talk to us and not pledge, but we'd like to have you pledge. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'll remind you as we go into this discussion that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. And in the continuing conversations taking place at Open Society Institute Baltimore puts on, talking about race, another one takes place tomorrow night at 7 p.m. And it's Why Are African-American Males Struggling in School? Two of the men, the two men speaking about that tomorrow night, one's in the studio now, Dr. Raymond Winbush, director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. In a few minutes, Dr. Ivory Tolson will be with us as well. And he is associate professor at Howard University, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Negro Education, and senior research analyst at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. And so, Ray, what we were talking about before we went to break were all these reports that come out, sent to me by a number of foundations, people involved in education, that show a correlation between the great academic growth for kids coming from poor communities going to suburban upper-class schools than when they're left back in the inner cities.
Well, you know, I always distinguish between being educated and being trained. you know, I want to say, and I believe this because I've had the experience, when I taught at Vanderbilt University, I had a number of black students who were kind of upper middle class who could afford Vanderbilt, which at that time was thousands of dollars. I don't know what it is right now.
Tens of thousands of dollars.
Yes,
now. Yes,
absolutely. Right, they would come to me, and this was not an exception. I mean, I would say of, let's say, 100 students, 50 of them would come to me, or I would hear about them saying things like, you know, I got the best education in my life in a suburban school. I was the only black kid in the class, but I don't know anything about myself. So academically, they were sound, they made the grade and so forth. But psychologically, I met many of them who sounded like Herman Cain. I mean, and that is a, you know, deliberate casting of aspersion.
I figured it was.
Yeah. But, and so, you know, parents always ask me, well, should I send my child to an all-white school? Should I send my child to an all-black school? I said, look, if your child is talking like Clarence Thomas, you know, I would probably add now to Herman Cain, I said, send them to an HBCU. If they're talking like Malcolm X, you can send them any place. So I think that we got to distinguish between what we mean by just because a child makes great, good, you know, grades in school doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to turn out okay as a black person in the society. And just because a child doesn't make good grades doesn't mean that that's a potential Malcolm X in them as well. It just depends.
So what there's so many variables here.
There are.
There's a map we can't show on the air, but I can describe it. And I want to show it to you as I'm speaking about it. Let me just pull it up here real fast. Here we go. This Schott State report on black males in education.
Yes.
You know about this, right?
I really wish Ivory was on.
Why don't you
slide? I really wish Ivory was on.
He'll be here in a few minutes.
Yeah, because he'll really go to town.
But what the map says when they show where kids are dropping out, black males, young black men are dropping out of schools, that these red states are where they're dropping out in the greatest numbers. I'm wrong. The green states where they're dropping out in greater numbers, and those are places where the places are majority white.
Exactly. Kentucky, West Virginia. I'm looking at the map.
Right.
Audience. Utah. There's not that many black folk out there. Idaho. Montana, North and South Dakota. Well, and I think that says something right there, that the study that was done by Robert Williams of George Washington University a few years ago, he actually looked at where successful black folk came from. They came from places where there were pockets or colonies, as he called it, of black people. Tuskegee, Alabama. Many of them came from the Gullah Geechee Islands off the coast of South Carolina and Georgia. They came from places where there was a lot of black support. Clearly, they came from HBCUs. I don't even want to start the list of, you know, where black leadership emerges from relative to HBCUs. So again, I think it's more than a coincidence that that map shows that the black students and the Latino students who are failing tend to be in areas where there's not a large black or Latino population.
So,
again, this is unpopular what I'm saying, but it's so much, there's so much data to it, but you keep going, we'll talk.
Let's look at Baltimore for an example,
yeah.
Since we're sitting, talking here from Baltimore. When I was a kid, the school system was segregated. And then when I went to high school, mm-hmm. The integration really began, at least in some high schools.
Mm-hmm.
City, Poly, Western, Eastern, those high schools became
right.
Interracial. I think City, when I was there, was two-thirds white, one-third black. Mm-hmm. A lot of the black leadership of this community in Baltimore and Maryland came out of those schools.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So what does that play into that scheme of things? I mean, in terms of what integration might or might not be?
I'm not going to say that integration is all bad, but I'm certainly not going to say it's all good.
Right.
I definitely don't think it's all good. I think that what you've got to look at is what happened to Baltimore public school system. For example, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. When I was a kid millions of years ago, Baltimore at one time had the highest per capita rate of black-owned businesses in the United States of a large city. It was also known as the city of white steps. And
right.
When I grew up, we said, man, when I grow up, I'm going to move to Baltimore. That was kind of like the way Atlanta is in the black community right now. You see a major turn, and I've been talking to a lot of people around the city, and people give various urban legends about it. But people talk about the change in Baltimore came with the riots, that black white people started the exodus out of the big cities into the suburbs like they did in Detroit, Newark, Cleveland, my hometown. Definitely in L.A. with the Watts riot,
right.
And that concomitant loss of white tax dollars and everything messed the school systems up. So, again, even though that leadership came out of there, the question is, could that leadership come out of there now? I think sometimes it does. And I see bright students at some of the schools like Poly and all these other schools that are very good in the city. But I think that you would have had more had there been – again, an emphasis on desegregation rather than integration.
Now, when you look at segregated schools, and I want to come back to what we think we need to do about this. I mean, how do we have to wrestle with this in America, both individually, both as a systemic issue and as intervention mm-hmm. models before you get systemic change. But when you look at segregation, and I had this conversation, I remember one night at a friend's home, there was a party, and people were talking about how, you know, they went to Douglas mm-hmm. High School in the 40s, and it's been about Douglas High School in Baltimore in the 40s and 50s, and how everybody was successful out of those schools, and how everybody achieved something, and there was order and discipline in the schools, and people learned, and they had incredible teachers. But there were two things, how these variables work out. I'm going to mm-hmm. see your comment. One of my questions was, how many students were there that graduated?
Mm-hmm.
Was it 500? Was it 1,000?
Mm-hmm.
And if that was the only school the black folks could go to, then we're talking about thousands of people who didn't go to the schools at all. So it was probably mostly working class, middle class black families that ended up with their kids in Douglas,
mm-hmm.
which was a different – That's type different, of the, right?
Exactly. No, you're right. Go on.
Let me just leave it there for a minute. But that's a piece of what – and also the other part was we're talking about the faculty. Well, at Douglas, you know, as example, the great Matthew Henson,
yes,
who went to the North and South Pole before anybody else did,
yes,
taught science. Well, he wouldn't be teaching science at Douglas today. He'd be at Harvard or Maryland or UMBC.
We would still have the Royal Theater. We would still have Pennsylvania Avenue. And see, again, black folk, I'm not just talking about white folk, black folk don't like to talk about the downside of integration. They don't. They resist it because they say, well, aren't we better off now than we were then? And again, it's a qualified yes on that. I wasn't in Baltimore at that time, but I've heard the legends of Pennsylvania Avenue being comparable to Harlem in terms of the Cotton Club and everything else like that. And when I first got moved to Baltimore 9 years ago, someone took me past the spot where the Royal Theater used to be, right near the Billie Holiday statue. It's gone.
It's gone.
And everybody I talked to who remembers that said that was the center of entertainment in Baltimore. Like Douglas was the center of education in Baltimore. So segregation had its ups and its downs, but there, and we usually like to talk about the ups, but then we get nostalgic about the ups that used to be that aren't anymore. And I think that we got to talk about both of them.
So when we come back from this break, I mean, let's tackle what interventions have to take place. Yeah. Maybe by the time Dr. Avery Tolson will be joining us, what interventions have to take place, but also beyond the interventions, what systemic changes have to take place,
that's good,
which are maybe in some ways more important than the interventions.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with my dear friend Dr. Raymond Winbush and this conversation. And we take a break now to talk about your favorite radio station. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. You can buy a house in Baltimore. It'd be amazing how easy it is. Call 1-800-638-7781. We're here in studio with Dr. Raymond Winbush, Director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, along with Dr. Ivory Tolson. We'll be speaking tomorrow night as part of the continuing OSI series on race, looking at why African-American young men have this huge achievement gap in our country. So, Raymond, where we left off was this idea of what do you do?
I mean,
because people on one hand talk a lot about intervention strategies, and some people would argue that all the intervention strategies in the world won't amount to a hill of beans without some serious systemic, not just educational change, but change in the economic structure of America.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I have no problems whatsoever and am a witness to the effectiveness of intervening with black boys educationally. We got to do that.
We have to do it.
But I always tell educators that if you only do one of two necessary things, you're going to fail. You've got to intervene with the boy and you've got to intervene with the society that the boy is coming from. I'm still amazed how many times I will talk to a group of white teachers, oftentimes black teachers, and parents. And they say, it's like, let's focus on the boy. Again, as I said earlier, let's fix him. I say, okay, while we're fixing this boy, let's talk about some of the things that you can do to fix the systems that they're in. Let's see if we can talk about teachers that go from, that get C's and D's in graduate school and schools of education being assigned to inner city schools and the better teachers being assigned to suburban schools. Let's talk about issues of equipment. Let's talk about classroom overcrowding, a variety of things. So you've got to intervene with the child, but you got to do at least something to deal with the system that they're in. And oftentimes we don't want to do that because we see the system as being too big. You can see in our history, clearly there was an intervention, and ironically, in 1954 with Brown versus Board, that they, you know, these kids were going to inferior schools, Thurgood Marshall, we know the story. But there was an intervention with the society as well, and we don't want to do that anymore. We're more reluctant to do that anymore because we see it as being very big.
Well, I mean, there's some people who, again, other studies that write over and over again that all these intervention strategies are meaningless in the face of the poverty that faces communities of color in mm-hmm. America. Mm-hmm. That's the real issue. The real issue is the dislocation of people's lives. The real mm-hmm. issue is how the economic system has destroyed families and how the prison culture has taken over the streets. Mm-hmm. That is what you're battling against when it comes to systemic change. So you can have these great programs that can save 50 kids, 100 kids, 1,000 kids, but you're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of kids who will not be affected by those interventions.
Well, see, this is the dilemma that any black social scientist and my Latino brothers and sisters face, and a lot of very well-meaning white social scientists. I attended a conference about 3 weeks ago in Dallas, Texas, with Michelle Alexander. She's the author of The New Jim Crow. And it was a closed conference. People like Jeremiah Wright was there. I don't want to even name a huge group of people. And it was kind of a small conference of about maybe 150 people. And we talked about the prison industrial complex. Michelle is convinced, as I am, that the system of incarceration of black males is the new slavery. This is the new slavery. There are more black males in prison right now than there are at the height of enslavement in this country. So what Michelle says, and I would extend that to the educational system, when you're talking about intervening to stop the prison industrial complex, you're not talking about something you're going to do overnight with a march on the mall or something like that. It's something that's going to take years to deal with. If you read the works of Charlie Houston and Thurgood Marshall in the late 1940s, they knew, and Charlie Houston never lived to see the end of segregation,
right,
as you know. But they didn't say this is going to be – it's a marathon. And I think that black people and well-meaning white people, Latinos and other groups have to say, we're going to do something about the wholesale incarceration, miseducation of black males in this society. We've got to talk about a long-term strategy that is not going to be seen in the next 2 or 3 years, but in many years to come. And a lot of people don't want to tackle that.
So how do you balance that effort, that strategy, that struggle, as I keep being these two ideas? One is the intervention that there's, I mean, we can both sit here and name two dozen programs around the United States of America that are doing incredible work with young black men mm-hmm. in inner cities mm-hmm. of America, that are turning lives around that would end up in the prison pipeline, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that, and you have that on the one level. But then it's the larger question you're talking about, that you it's a political battle.
It is. It's political. It's not just educational. And that's what teachers
and people say. You think you're making excuses when you say that,
but,
too.
But see, that's the part. People say things. Well, you're playing the race card. You know, what are we talking about? There's another social program or whatever. But that is what it takes. I mean, you could say the biggest intervention that was made in black people's lives in the past 100 years was the desegregation of the United States public school system. That was an intervention. But we don't want to do that now because it seems so big and it's easier to focus on the intervention. We were doing some research on a Baltimore education in the early 19-teens. There was a huge influx of Eastern European immigrants to Baltimore. And the entire public school system, I mean, it's in the record, the entire public school system was shifted to accommodate these Eastern Europeans who were coming here to work on the docks, Domino Sugar, all over the place like that. They shifted the educational system to accommodate them. Why can't they do that for black and Latino kids? We see a little bit of it with Latino intervention, but with like teaching of language and so forth. But we tend to not, we want to see black kids as being chocolate covered white kids that, you know, that they're just, they don't know how to learn if they just only acted white. And I think that we don't want to deal.
You say right or white?
White.
White.
Yeah. Why can't they act white?
Right.
You know, why can't they be like our kids that live in the suburbs and stuff like that? These two guys, you know, years ago, they called it rumors of inferiority. There's always been this undercurrent that somehow black children are inferior or black people are inferior, and that inferiority extends to how they learn, their cultural, you know, modalities, whatever. And I think that we've got to talk about this at a systemic level and intervening at that level.
But we have, you know, in my conversation I had the last couple of days, we even have now that that nobody in politics, from the president on down, want to talk about poverty, want to talk about the prison reform and criminal justice reform, want to talk about what it takes to put people back to work. And you look in Baltimore City, I mean, you're not going to turn Baltimore City schools around, it seems to me, Raymond Winbush, unless you change the tax structure and how you invest in education. Because this is a poor city, and to equalize it, going to take more than just simple interventions and reforms.
Well, but see, I think again, I'm going to give a quick example. Milwaukee had a real bad issue of violence about 15 years ago, and they found out, and we know the research that the presence of ambient lead in the environment. I'm talking about lead in the environment. Increases violent behavior. There's a professor at the University of Pittsburgh that's done all of this research.
Right.
We know that Baltimore, and the way they intervene in Milwaukee, by the way, they changed the windows of several houses throughout the areas where lead was, because the lifting of windows creates lead dust, which the kids, the violence rate dropped among young people and everything. We could do the same thing in Baltimore, but see, that's a systemic intervention. Is something that would take the will of politicians, policymakers in general, educators, to say, why don't we do something about intervening about the presence of lead in Baltimore? People don't want to do that. It costs money. It costs time and effort. And you don't. It's not as sexy as just simply saying, we're going to reform the school system or something like that.
Now, I have to, before we run out of time, I want to go back to something you said earlier. So what conclusions did y'all come to at this meeting you had? About the prison.
We're all doing some things that you're going to hear about in about 3 months. That's all I can say. We shut out the press because there were a lot of controversial people at this thing. Good people, colleagues of mine for many, many years. But you're going to be hearing a lot about it come January 1st.
All right. I mean, we
I'm going to leave it at that.
That's cool. They can't put stuff out there until it's ready to get out there.
Right.
Okay. You know, Raymond Bush, I tell you, it is always an honor and pleasure to have you in the studio.
Well, keep up what you're doing, Mark.
It's great to see you, and I'm going to encourage everybody tomorrow night to go to the Enoch Pratt Free Library on Cathedral Street, 7 p.m., the downtown branch, the central branch. He will be there along with Dr. Ivory Tolson from Howard University talking about black male achievement, part of the continuing Open Society Institute Baltimore's conversations on race in our society. It'll be a really interesting evening. And so join them, and I'm going to try to make my way down there after the show myself. Dr. Raymond Winbush and Ivory Tolson will be there to speak with you, and you can also have a dialogue with them afterwards. And Dr. Winbush, thank you, brother.
Thank you, man.
So go away. Oh, before we got out of here, I got to say one more thing, because if I don't, this is part of how we pay our bills here on the Mark Steiner Show, and I got to do that even if we raise money for WEAA without this. I can't. There we go. Here we go. No, where is it? Here it is. Okay, good. I want to say, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to topics and events you care about most. Daily content and arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. We'll be right back to talk about your favorite radio station. Stay with us.